I'm Ross Heide, and my role here for these weeks is to talk about history. And we're going to today look at missionary pastors in Alaska. I'm going to focus part of my talk on a rather fascinating fellow with a strange name, Eunosigneus. Apparently he did what Melanchthon had done. Melanchthon's name was Schwarzerd, Black Earth, and he thought he had translated into Greek. So Melanchthon is, that's his name. Eunosigneus, some of you who know that language know it speaks of swan, and so his name in Swedish had been swan, changed it to Signeus. However, it seems to me that one cannot properly talk about one individual slicing into the history of a region, because that denies the role of others who preceded. And so, with your permission, we'll just take a quick hop, skip, and jump through the earlier chapters of that fascinating great land, as they call it. And remember that they think that the land bridge was made it possible for people to cross over into that area, and the natives, you can read the various suggestions of the length of their habitation there, but the native chapter, you could say, at least the National Geographic map, which is a very valuable historical resource, says it's 1700 to 1743 was the native Russia. That was bothered by the influx of the traders who came to seek the sea otter, that fur-bearing animal that whose pelt brought such rich rewards if you got it to Canton, China. And so the traders, the Russian traders, made their way up in almost impossibly crude sailing ships, and they began to come up there searching for these fur pelts. And then they were able to be granted a charter for the Russian American Company. And in the early years, their settlement was way out on the Aleutian, way out to Unalaska, and then in closer, Three Saints Bay. And that was their first chapter there, and they moved in 1792 to Kodiak, and that was while Baranov was the general, the governor for the Russian American Company. Kodiak's a fascinating island, never dreamed we'd ever get out there, but I met in at the Billy Graham School of Evangelism a Lutheran pastor who was serving there, and I got a letter the next spring asking me to come up and supply the parish while he was away for 5 weeks. So my wife and I spent 5 weeks on Kodiak, which gave me access to their library, which is outstanding, and also the Russian Orthodox Seminary, which is in Kodiak, St. Herman Seminary. And that let me visit the Veniaminov Historical Institute, and opened a door of greater understanding into the life of probably one of the most gifted Christian missionaries that ever touched that whole vast land of Alaska. I'd like to just share a bit about him. A three-volume edition of Veniaminov has been prepared by the Russian Orthodox St. Vladimir's Seminary Press. They put out a one-volume edition, and I happened to pick one up some years ago. And I found him to be just one of those rare personalities who's a delight to know about. He was born in 1797 in the family of a person who was a sacristan, a helper within the Russian Orthodox Church. His father died, and his uncle took him to live with him. His uncle worked for the Russian Orthodox Church. His uncle and his uncle's wife had been caring for a parish. For them, the The term sacristan meant more than it does in the liturgical language today. It was the man who not only cared for some of the worship, but also took care of the building and was an assistant in the liturgy. And he grew up in these formative years of boyhood under the care of this couple who were very active within the liturgical life, and his uncle would teach him as a little boy to read. And on Christmas Day, when the little lad was just a boy, he read the lesson in the Christmas liturgy, which is pretty difficult to understand. But then his aunt died, and they moved to the site of the seminary, Irkutsk. And in that situation, he became very strongly influenced by the Russian Orthodox life and faith, and was confirmed there, and then later entered the seminary. While he was studying, his uncle, who had mechanical gifts, trained him and helped him develop mechanical skills. And then while he was at seminary, they decided they wanted a good clock in the bell tower. And by this time, John Papanov had become literally one of the outstanding students in the seminary. And he was so fascinated by this master clockmaker that came that he attached himself to him as a helper. The clockmaker soon learned the skill of this young student, so he had him carve the gears and the wheels. And then the seminary was angry that he was giving time to this, but found that his schoolwork hadn't slacked off any, and so they permitted him to do both. Now, all of this was a strange preparation for an experience that came when a missionary bishop came through and gave a call to the students, and especially to one man who was supposed to go as a missionary priest to Alaska. And so on this one day, he gave this very dramatic lecture about the need. 10 Alaskan missionaries had gone over into the Aleutians to be there with the Russians who were gathering sea otter pelts. And the one who was supposed to go during that night must have gotten cold feet. Anyway, he absolutely refused to consider to go. And so that news was released in the seminary community, and the strangest thing happened. John Papanov, through all the hours of that night, had been literally fascinated by the challenge of Alaska and the Aleutians and ministering to the Aleut people. And so he came forward to this missionary bishop and volunteered to go. And so he did go. By this time he was married. You know, there are two classes of priests, the unmarried priests who are the only candidates to be bishop, and the married priests who may be parish priests. And so he took this long, adventuresome journey over, and his first parish was way out in the chain, the little village of Unalaska. And very quickly, I'll digest his life there. He learned to know and love the people. He realized that to minister effectively, he had to learn the language. He not only learned the language, but he learned how to write it. He developed an alphabet. He translated Matthew's gospel. He wrote the liturgy in Aleut, and he trained the people to sing the service. But more than that, he was a tremendous Renaissance man. He loved to know all he could about the geography about him, the terrain, the plants, the animals, the birds, and he took very, very prolific notes about all of this. He took weather observations, he measured the rainfall, he watched the wind, he studied the ocean currents, everything he could, and he wrote journals, a tremendous quantity of these, and he kept all of these records. To his surprise, when a Russian exploring ship put into port and was becalmed there by heavy fog and conditions that would not permit them to leave, aboard this ship was a Russian scientist. And he was amazed to find that this parish priest was really quite a scientist. And the priest opened up, by the way, this man's name now, he had been given a new name. Apparently John Papanov was like John Smith. and there were 10 of them in the seminary. And a new president or bishop of the seminary came, and he decided he wasn't going to worry about John Popenoff and add to that the birthplace town. And so he just came to this John Popenoff and said, "You're going to be Benjamin." And in Russian, it was Veniaminov. And so that's how John Popenoff became Veniaminov. And so that's why he's later known as the Apostle to America and Veniaminov. The scientists saw all of the charts, all the weather observation, all the collected plant specimens, and he immediately developed a deep friendship with Veniaminov, and then he found to his joy that this priest gladly gave him all of his records to take back to the university in Russia. And then every year Veniaminov would send another shipment back, and as a result he became known in Russia as an outstanding scholar. But he was a faithful priest. He loved his people. He had all the boys and girls trained to go out and take the weather observations and how high up was the float in the little measuring device. And the people loved him, and they responded to his ministry. And he found they surely needed a church, so he built a church. He trained the natives to help him, and he even had an onion dome at the top. And he did the proper icons, and all of the liturgical needs were met by what he did. And he had a ministry that was effective. When they decided to move the church then to Kodiak, when Baranov decided that that would be a better center, because their earlier place at Three Saints Bay was not a good port, he for a while went there, and then later they were going to go to Kodiak. But by this time, he had been called back to Russia. And he was back with the Orthodox authorities in St. Petersburg, but he was rather disappointed. The leaders had very little time for him. After all, who was he? A parish priest from a godforsaken country way out there in, what is it, Alaska. And so he got no time. But that may be true at church headquarters, but what about at the university? Oh, he was lionized. He was welcomed. He was invited to lecture, and the people flocked to hear him. And they came by the hundreds to hear him tell his story of life with the Aleutians in that rather forbidding climate and rocky islands and difficult place. But they loved it. And then the news got over to the church headquarters that at the university, this little quiet parish priest was really being given great honors and citations. And so they called him in and listened to him, discovered something of his gifts. He was there for some time. During the time he was there, the news came. He had brought his wife over to the Irkutsk Peninsula. In Russia, the news came that his wife had died. Now, this opened a possibility for them, because they now knew that the growth of the church in this area was such that they needed a bishop. So they approached Veniaminov, "Would you become a bishop?" Which meant he had to become a monk and take church orders and vow celibacy. And he sorrowed for his wife, and he thought of this, and he accepted it, and became a monk, and was elevated to bishop. And so it was that when he came back, he came down not to Kodiak or Unalaska, but all the way down to New Archangel, what is now Sitka. And in the meantime, the strangest thing had happened. There had come into New Archangel, of all things, a pastor of a non-Orthodox religion, Lutheran, and his name was Eunos Ignatius. He found that he was firmly entrenched with the good favor of the governor, a new governor, Edward Atelin, and his wife was a devout Lutheran. Fact is, we have to back up for just a bit and learn how this man, Cygnaeus, happened to come. Cygnaeus had been born in a family where his parents, his grandfather, had been bishop, of all things, bishop down in Russia. There were so many Lutherans down around St. Petersburg that they were permitted to have a Lutheran bishop in Russia. And they had very strong congregations around Petersburg. Now, Cygnaeus grew up in a poor family, and while he was young, his father died. He managed to make his way through. He ended up with financial obligations, but he went to a school and then the Turku Academy and the University of Turku. He got his master's degree in biology and zoology, and then he was spent a year studying theology and was ordained and became a minister in Turku. He then went on down and later, but at this point he was there. Then the news came that there was a possibility of a Lutheran congregation in Russia and Alaska. How could that be? Well, it all goes back to the power of a woman. The newly appointed governor, a naval officer who had served with distinction with the Navy in commanding ships, caring for the trade and the needs of the Russian colony, had moved up the ladder and had received such fine praise that as they needed to search for another governor, his name was brought up. His record was so superb that he was approached. Would he accept this promotion and go back not as Captain Edward Atelin, but as the governor? And then in a quiet aside, they said, of course, this means that you must take a wife with you. And this bachelor of 40-some years choked twice. And then he said, but I've been away so long, I don't even know a single young woman. How could you think that I might somehow find someone and persuade her to marry me and go with me to Alaska? And they said, well, that's a requirement we can't waive. And so they got their heads together and his friends put together a plan. They planned a great dance, a great ball. And to this they invited all the eligible unmarried women. And then they managed to arrange it that he could meet them. And one of them really caught his eye. She was a very delightful young woman, attractive, poised. And he found that she also was a very devout Lutheran Christian. And she accepted his friendship and his courtship approach. And then when he proposed, she by this time had grown to like him. And she said that she would consider it with one proviso, and that is there had to be a Lutheran pastor, for she said, I could not think of being away so far from my home country unless I had the comfort and solace of a Lutheran worship opportunity. Now that meant that not only did the governor have to have found a wife, but now he had to find a pastor who was willing to go far off to Alaska, and that meant hardship, loneliness, and they finally, the word got around, and this pastor, Eunos Cygnaeus, who was laboring under the difficulty of financial debts for his education, and also an interest in this experience, said that he would go. And so it was that this trip was made, and in September of 1839, on the ship Nikolai, Pastor Eunos Cygnaeus went with Governor Atelin and his wife. They'd been married quite a number of months by this time, because it took a long time for this preparation. And their long journey is traced here in the map in red, coming from Helsinki, coming down with a stop at Copenhagen, and then down to England, where they stopped at Plymouth for a while, and then a long ocean journey to Rio de Janeiro, where they stopped, then around the Cape, and a stop at Santiago. And in Santiago, he was there during the days he was there. He performed a marriage for one of the German couples that wanted to be married. Then a long journey up. As they crossed the equator, a baby boy was born to Mrs. Atelin. And a couple days later, in the diary of Pastor Eunice Ignaeus, he records that he baptized this little baby boy with water from the Pacific Ocean. They landed up at New Archangel on the 12th of May, 1840. Now, the bishop of Alaska, the Orthodox bishop, had not come back. And so he arrived in this place with restrictions. He may only minister to the Lutherans, which meant the Finnish Lutherans, the Swedish Lutherans, the Germans who perhaps had been living in the Baltic states, some Latvians, and many of the Finns, as you may know, spoke Swedish. And so he had the Finnish language, the Swedish language, and German, which was known by many people. There was no church. He began by visiting the people in their homes, the men in the barracks where they lived. And then he learned the realism of the tragedy of life in Alaska. Because many, many of the single men developed a relationship with a native woman, developed a common law marriage, and children were born. And this was a growing population. In 1799, there were no Creoles, as they called these children from mixed marriages, but by 1839, there were 1,318, according to the population. So here this man who had come from a strong church, a church so powerful and so sizable that in his girls' confirmation class, his girl confirmands numbered over 200. The whole congregation that he was to care for in New Archangel, 150. At their first service, only 20 came. But then they were meeting in a room in what was called Baranoff's Castle. Those of you who've been to Sitka know that you go and then there's this hill at the end of the street. You walk up to that and there is the little diagram of what this was when a huge house had been built by Governor Baranoff. A room in that castle was permitted to be used for worship, but the sensitive Signaeus learned that the people who were the workers did not readily come there. It's interesting, it was a temperament problem with the new governor. He was a law and order man. He kept things a tight ship, unlike the previous one who had been a kind of folksy governor and relaxed and friendly. Atelin made things pretty stern and rigid. And it wasn't until they built their first church that the people began to respond, and 120 of them came to the first service in the new church. As they were planning to build it, Bishop, the Orthodox Bishop Veniaminov arrived and was very, very upset to learn there was to be another church, not Orthodox, because the Orthodox were used to being in complete control. And yet he couldn't oppose it because it was Governor Atelin's idea, and the governor's wife was behind it. And so they finally had to work out a compromise, a most interesting one, which is still evident if you see the church in Sitka today. The rule was the church is all right, but it must not look like a church. No spire, no steeple, no bells, because it was only 100 feet from the Russian Orthodox Cathedral, which was not yet built. The Lutheran church was built by the Finnish and Swedish carpenters, and then the Russian cathedral was built. It had been meeting in another building, not quite as imposing as the one that they did build. And so they started. The things that had disturbed this pioneer pastor were three: drunkenness, gambling, and sexual immorality. trying to deal with this problem. He was bold enough in his preaching to try to touch upon this, and this really angered the governor. The governor did not think there ought to be specific doctrine, and that sermons should be just about spiritual things, and certainly should not make any specific comments about personal behavior. I don't want you to think that this is just an idea that there was a bad scene in Sitka. Sir George Simpson, a director of the Hudson Bay Company, and in his journal Narrative of Travels, gives his eyewitness account of life in New Archangel. Of all the drunken as well as the dirty places that I have visited, New Archangel, Sitka, was the worst. On the holidays in particular, of which Sundays included, there are 165 in the year, that's the Russian Orthodox liturgical calendar, men, women, and even children were to be seen staggering about in all directions. The common houses were nothing but wooden hovels, huddled together without order or design in nasty alleys, which breed all sorts of fever. Now, Cygnaeus spoke against this and tried to challenge people to live chaste lives, and his sermons were really reproved. He was reproved by Governor Aitken. We have an excerpt of one of those sermons. You might find it interesting. In 1841, he preached, "God has planted in human beings, as in all living creatures, an instinct for increasing the human race." Now, I think this bachelor does a pretty good job in this. He states it very, very well. "It is holy because its purpose is holy. According to the sacred rules of Christianity, it should never be satisfied except in a legal and chaste marriage. It is the holy duty of all parents to teach their children to respect their own bodies as temples of the Holy Spirit. They must teach them modesty and decency in words, behavior, and actions, and to regard marriage and the true purpose of sexual intercourse as sacred. Children must be early taught the value of serious work and devout praying. It is best that parents teach these important and holy things to their children before immoral and godless people, through their frivolous talk, defile them." Now, whether the governor heard the sermon or not, he heard about it. And in a letter to his sister, Cygnaeus later wrote that a high authority expressed to me great indignation about this sermon. Perhaps it was a year later when Aitken was much again irritated because he found out that the letters that Cygnaeus had written to his family back in Finland and about the conditions and the difficulties in Russian Alaska had been printed in newspapers. And so the governor was really upset with it. Well, let me summarize it by saying that Pastor Cygnaeus stayed there 5 years, from 1840 to 1845. In this time, he ministered in the community, and often he would go on voyages with the governor as they went to outlying posts. We have a sentence from a citizen, a German who was living in Kodiak, and Cygnaeus went as far away as Kodiak with a ship, and then in a response that came from this German, he says, "To think that in this far off place I have the great joy of receiving the Holy Sacrament from a Lutheran pastor." This service was held aboard ship as they were brought in, and then he had a little communion service. So Cygnaeus traveled and cared for the people, and he also learned to get along with Bishop Van Nieuwenhof. By the time he had come back and left to return, he had had the sad duty of burying the little boy he had baptized at sea. And this is kind of a reminder to me that the lifespan of children born in frontier places was not very predictably long. Now, he went, remember, across this way to get up to Alaska. But on his return, they crossed over to Siberia, and he returned overland. And let me just tell you a bit, and very quickly, what happened to Cygnaeus when he came back. He came back to be the director of a school, because education had always fascinated him. When the Finnish government asked that, because they were considering putting in common education through the country, and it had not been available, they asked people to propose what they thought ought to be done. And among those who submitted essays was Pastor Juno Cygnaeus. His response to the Finnish government was so outstanding that they called him in. And they said, we would like to have you prepare yourself to direct this whole program in the country of Finland. So they sent him on a trip through Europe. They sent him to down to Germany, they sent him to Switzerland, they sent him to France, they sent him to Holland. He was supposed to go to England, a teacher's training college. And Cygnaeus was the president and the leader and director of this school. So for the rest of his life, this pastor, who had gone out as a missionary pastor to Alaska, became the outstanding educator for the country of Finland. He passed on in 1888, and the tragic chapter of the Sitka Lutheran Church was that this congregation had kind of become so weak that it had literally died. Because when they sold Alaska to the Americans in 1867, many of those who had come to work went back to Russia or to Finland, and so the congregation dwindled. The church was building was unused. The Sheldon Jackson College came in and took their altar and their communion railing and the organ that had been sent from Estonia, the first organ in any church in the whole Pacific area. They carefully protected that in the museum at Sheldon Jackson College. And when in the 1940s the congregation was reactivated, those things were brought back and have been brought back to the church. So we're really deeply indebted to them. I'd like to spend the last minutes moving ahead to talk about what happened in the ministries in Alaska following these times. But if you've read a book like Michener's Alaska, you've gotten some of the feel of what happened. You became aware of the different chapters as Alaska attracted people for fur and for fish and for timber and then oil, and of course tourism today. But in 1867, there came a time of real chaos in Alaska. They sent no judges up there. They had no plan for education. The ones who came up to occupy it was 200 soldiers who had been fighting Indians in Montana. They had really no people with any sensitivity or graciousness. The Russians, with some kind of grace, welcomed them as they came, and then they ran down the Russian flag, and then they ran up the American flag, and then the Americans, without any tenderness or sensitivity, said, now we want to have the castle, and had them move out, and took over, and there was a chapter of abuse of the native women by the soldiers, and in the years that followed, the only bright ray of hope were the Christian mission stations that were along what was the Alaska country. And among the ones who were active there was a tremendously gifted person named Sheldon Jackson. Sheldon Jackson had come through the United States, ministering in the West, out in Colorado, He came across up into the Northwest, and then Alaska became his beacon. He printed a card, Sheldon Jackson, missionary to Alaska. Back at the Presbyterian headquarters, they about flipped because they hadn't said that that was his role, but he assumed it. And so he went up there, going up with the American ship that went up in the spring, sailing with a captain, surveying things. They started a church and then a school in Sitka. He found the other areas. He realized that since there was no plan for education and the natives desperately needed to be prepared for life, he proposed that the different denominations would accept an area within the coastal communities primarily. And so when there were some without it, he went out and recruited denominations. The Quakers came and did an excellent ministry from down around Whittier, California. He went back to Reading, Pennsylvania, and persuaded the Mennonites to accept a mission field, and they did up in the Kuskokwim River Basin. And their record is excellent. They have a fine history of their ministry up there. They immediately began to train natives. They have a completely native ministry now. All the pastors are natives. It's administered by natives, and they've given a real model program in this regard. With interesting evidence of his spirit, Sheldon Jackson, as he was parceling out the various fields, he says, well, now we are Presbyterians are in Sitka, and that's one of the choice fields, so we should take a tough field. So he said, we'll take Point Barrow, way up in the top. Nobody wants to go there, so Presbyterians will go there. And in the 1984, when I went up to Anchorage for the Billy Graham Crusade, I met a Pastor Armstrong, a former neighbor of mine in Berkeley, who was the Presbyterian pastor up at Point Barrow. And I listened to him as he told about what has happened, especially the tremendous economic impact, because that became a stronger community and received a lot of money from North Slope. So this was a development in all of that. Now, you remember the gold rush came into the Klondike, but it also, in a later year, came to the Seward Peninsula when they discovered gold on the beaches at Nome. And that really led to a very interesting chapter, the reindeer chapter of Lutheran ministry in Alaska. And Brevi is the man who came in. Sheldon Jackson, when the caribou was decimated by miners, decided that they had to find some source for the natives. And as he and this boat that he would travel in, the U.S. boat that would come up every spring, they touched base in Siberia, and then he saw the reindeer being herded by Siberians. And he said, that might work over there in the Seward Peninsula. And so he was able to get a few reindeer, and then a few more, and then to teach the Eskimos how to care for them, he brought over a couple of Siberian reindeer herders. It failed miserably. They were very abrupt, harsh, and cruel, and the Eskimos rebelled. They came to them and says, we will not work with these people. And poor Sheldon Jackson had a venture here that was going to die of warning. And so he said, is there a possibility we can find some Christian reindeer herders? So he began to inquire, and he found that the only ones available were in Lapland, way up in Scandinavia. And there was a group of Christian, happened to be Lutheran, reindeer herders. So he contacted the Norwegian Lutheran Church in Minneapolis. They found a pastor who was willing to be with them. And the long of and short of it is that Sheldon Jackson went over to Scandinavia. He brought back 167 reindeer and 7 reindeer herders, Laplanders. They came across the United States, went by boat, got them back up there. They had lost some in the way, and this became a very successful venture. Some years later, at one point, they said the reindeer herd was 700,000. They even had a reindeer meat program coming down, bringing reindeer meat down into Seattle and into Northwest USA. But you can guess what happened. U.S. cattlemen protested, and they stopped it, stopped the import of reindeer, and the market was lost. Now, Brevig became a very beloved person. He was so sensitive in his dealing with the Eskimos, and they responded positively to the ministry, that today, if you go up in the Seward Peninsula, you'll find strong Lutheran Church and some other denominations too in Nome. Up at Teller, across the way in a mission station, they literally named Brevig's Mission. And then way up on Shishmaref, a little finger out into the Arctic Ocean where they have a ministry today. It's interesting to me that these very dominant, gifted personalities' lives interlock. Veniaminoff and Cygnaeus. And then later, Sheldon Jackson and a whole group of denominations. And then T.L. Brevig. One of our favorite people in the ministry to the Eskimos is a woman. She went up there as a nurse to help at Shishmaref, way up on that little point far up on this Seward Peninsula. Helen Frost very faithfully served there, cared for the people, became a friend and was beloved by them. There were a couple of times that there was no pastor. And so the Lutheran Church licensed her to conduct worship, perform baptism, lead Holy Communion. And she became an acting pastor. She came back when she left there, came back to Sitka. She was in Sitka when I was there in 1956. Then later on, she came down and she spent her last years in a Lutheran home in Carlsbad. My wife was going down there for a meeting at the Carlsbad home, and I said, "Evie, please, go say hello to Helen Frost." So she did. She came back, said, "Well, I did meet her." She had a nice chat with her. Helen has passed on, but one of the future little booklets that we're going to put out is her story of her ministry with the Eskimos. And she gave it the quaint title, Frost Among the Eskimos. And it's a very, very simple account of her experiences, one of them very surprising, and it's a kind of record we must keep. The ministry in a region like this is ecumenical. There must be cooperation. The needs are great, and the challenge is unending. I have no time to talk about what happened during the oil, and today the difficult challenge is ministering during the tourist season. I wish we had time for discussion. I violated all the rules of holding, but not letting you have a chance, but maybe if we have questions, you can ask them afterwards. I do have one thing, if you didn't pick up one. We've gotten involved in this whole process, working with other churches and other religious denominations, and this is a record of what is happening in the Lutheran History Center of the West. If you didn't get a copy of that, feel free to take one. It's just a 10-year report. I haven't heard the bell, but you want a question or two? Did I say enough about good Sheldon Jackson?
We visited that area and remember all that Sheldon Jackson said.
The campus is a very fine school. Excellent program there.
We were talking about the church.
Yes. Well, thank you. I guess we better fold up then. If you have any questions, feel free to come up.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.